I'm in shock. It's horrible. The first thing that comes to my mind is, when are we going to stop? When are we going to stop allowing people to buy guns? When are we going to ban semi-automatic weapons? How many people have to die? How many children have to be killed? How many children have to witness their parents being killed?
Half Moon Bay Mayor Deborah Penrose speaking to NBC earlier today after a mass shooting in her town last night. Seven people were killed. Another was hospitalized. The attack came in two waves at a pair of mushroom farms in the normally quiet seaside community south of San Francisco. The suspect was taken into custody, and authorities described the shootings as workplace violence. Hours later, just across the bay, another mass shooting took place in Oakland. One person was killed, and seven people were injured there. And of course, this all comes after Saturday's massacre at a ballroom in Monterey Park, about an hour after the city wrapped its Lunar New Year festival. We're going to talk about this, the community trauma, and where California's strict gun laws fit into all this with Dr. Garen Wintemute. He's an ER physician and the director of the Violence Prevention Research Program at UC Davis. Welcome back to Press Play.
Thanks for having me.
Well, the last time we had you on, it was after the Buffalo supermarket shooting. 10 people were murdered there, and then there was Uvalde after that. 19 elementary school students and their teachers, two teachers were killed, and now we have this. What is going through your mind?
Always my first reaction is grief and sorrow. As we sift through the pieces, we need to understand that a lot of people died. Thousands of other people have had their lives upended, and many of those people will never recover from the physical or psychological harm that they have suffered in the last few days. We need to keep this, I think, at a personal level, even as we try and understand the bigger picture.
Okay, so let's talk about California in particular. Mm-hmm. It has some of the strictest gun laws in the country. Mm-hmm. And overall, the death rates, as I understand mm-hmm. it, from gun violence have gone down since many of these laws were implemented. So where does California fit when it comes to these kinds of mass shootings?
You're absolutely right, and I am a glass more than half full person on this. We have probably more mass shootings than any other state does, but we are a huge state. Our mass shooting rate is substantially lower than it is in other states. Our firearm homicide rate is well below average. Our firearm suicide rate is among the lowest in the nation, and yes, for 20 years, until the pandemic upended things, California's firearm violence rates, death rates, were trending downward while they were trending upward in most of the rest of the country. It comes down to this. The laws that we have don't prevent every single instance of firearm violence, but they prevent lots of them. And as a physician, if I've got a medication that works 80% of the time, but not 100% of the time, that medication's not a failure for the missed 20%. It's a success for the 80%.
However, there was a ruling from a federal judge a few years ago in 2021, Judge Roger Benitez, which struck down California's assault weapons ban. So what do you anticipate will happen now?
Well, the assault weapons ban and the magazine ban, high-capacity magazine ban, and our understanding as of today is that an assault-type pistol was used in the Monterey Park shooting. I believe high-capacity magazines were used in both Monterey Park and Half Moon Bay. This is a judge who has equated the AR-15 assault rifle with a pocket knife.
A Swiss Army knife.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. We are nonetheless subject to those decisions. One of the difficulties California has faced in implementing tough laws is that those laws are undermined by what is sometimes called judicial sabotage. Another difficulty is that those laws, the effects of those laws, can be undermined by weaker laws in neighboring states.
Right. And so people can get guns from neighboring states legally
yes.
and bring them in.
Yes. Well, they may purchase them legally in those states. Yeah. It might be illegal to bring them into California, but they do that nonetheless. I used to do observational research at gun shows in Reno and would walk the parking lot, and more than 30% of the cars at that Nevada gun show were from California.
Hmm. But then it's illegal to bring them in, right?
It's illegal to bring them in, period, if the weapon is illegal in California.
Yeah.
It's generally illegal if you live in California to buy a gun in another state and bring it back. But people do it anyway.
Right. And yet, as you say, the death rates have gone down because of these patchwork of stricter California laws. However, we're reeling from all of these mass shootings, and you know, in the country, there have been nearly 40 mass shootings since mm-hmm. the year began. So, I think there's a sense of futility that these laws aren't working as well as they could.
So, I would like to address that. Thanks very much. Here's where that sense of futility comes in. I think that people look at a mass shooting, recognize this could be me, this could be my children, my grandchildren. Mass shootings are the one form of firearm violence about which nobody can come up with a story that leaves themselves out. Part of the difficulty is we expect somebody else to do something. We expect Congress to do something, but then we take a look at Congress and go, not much happening there. My point is that particularly with mass shootings, preventing them, the responsibility lies with all of us. The majority of public mass shooters declare their intentions in advance by one means or another. And that gives all of us both the opportunity and the responsibility to bring such threats to people who can do something about them. I'm thinking specifically about what we call here in California gun violence restraining orders, which allow certain private individuals and law enforcement to go to a judge and say, Your Honor, we have a crisis. Guns are part of the crisis. And if Her Honor agrees, she can issue a restraining order and have the guns removed from this situation. We have nearly 60 cases here in California where gun violence restraining orders were used in an effort to stop a mass shooting. And in none of those cases, 0 for 59, did a mass shooting occur. But for that policy to work, we all have to play our part. We have to convey those threats to people who can react to them.
How close are these mass shootings linked to episodes of domestic violence involving the alleged shooter?
So for these two, I don't think we know yet. But in general, two-thirds of public mass shootings have some sort of domestic or intimate partner violence connection. I should mention, public mass shootings of the sort that we're talking about today don't even account for most mass shootings. Most mass shootings are domestic intimate partner violence events. They don't occur in public places, so they don't get the notoriety that the recent cases have. But even public mass shootings are often connected in some way with domestic violence.
So, absent a big push to regulate guns, maybe take guns away from people, that's not going to happen, I don't think, in this country. It is, we have to look at that side of it, the mental health side of it, the behavioral side of it.
So, I will agree with you that we need to do a lot of things. There's no one solution to this problem. There are too many causes. We do need a much better mental health care system than we have. The major impact there will be on suicide, not on interpersonal violence. Mm-hmm. Mental illness is not a major cause of interpersonal violence. It is a major cause of self-harm. Madeline, just a moment ago, you said we won't take guns away from people. We'll dismiss that. Actually, here in California, we do that. There is a program here in California that our group is evaluating that identifies people who legally bought a gun but have since become prohibited. They've just been convicted of a violent crime or served with a domestic violence restraining order. And in California, we actually do go out and get those guns back. And our group is studying that policy to see if it's effective.
All right. Well, hopefully it is. Dr. Garen Wintemute is the director of the Violence Prevention Research Program at UC Davis. Thank you for coming back on the show today.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, the Oscar nominees are out. We will talk about some of the surprises next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, by now we all know that Everything Everywhere All at Once has swept the Oscar nominations with 11.
Mrs. Wang, are you with us?
I am paying attention.
Now, you may only see a pile of receipts, but I see a story. I can see where this story is going.
It does not look good.
The movie joins The Banshees of Inisherin, Women Talking, Top Gun Maverick, and six other films in the Best Picture category. Let's look now at some of the other categories with Pete Hammond, Deadline's awards columnist and chief film critic. Hi, Pete.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well. Okay, well, actually, before we get to some of the offbeat categories, let's talk about the main ones. Did anything surprise you today?
A couple of surprises. There have been so many pundits and critics and critics award shows and all kinds of things going on, trade ads, that you sort of know by the time you get to the nominations what is going to be nominated. And so I wasn't like overwhelmingly surprised by anything. Certainly in the Best Actress race, I would say Andrea Riseborough for Two Leslie, a movie that made $27,000 worldwide gross and that no one has heard of. $27,000 and change, and barely got released. But it was an underground campaign by a lot of major names in Hollywood, from Charlize Theron to Demi Moore, on and on and on. Cate Blanchett mentioned her in her acceptance speech at Critics' Choice when she won Best Actress for this tiny little movie, and they all like got together, and it just shows the power of that kind of guerrilla campaign, which is rare in Oscar history. You need a lot of money for these campaigns.
Yeah.
And she did it with almost no money, got the film on the Oscar screening platform that the Academy has. That's probably the biggest expenditure. I think it costs $20,000 to put your film on there so members can see it. Well, that was almost the entire gross of the film. But it's a gritty, wonderful little performance, and she got in.
Well, what is this movie about? Tell us.
It's about a woman. She's kind of addicted, has a bunch of addictions and things in her life. But she wants to open this little restaurant and she needs to get her act together, get her life together. So it's really a character study of a kind of down and out person trying to come back from a bad point in her life. And actors really responded to the performance. Some of them said one of the greatest performances they've ever seen. And she's playing an American character here, even though she is a British actress. Mm-hmm.
Okay, we have a clip, actually. And just to set this up, apparently she wins a lottery and then squanders.
She wins the lottery. That's at the beginning of the film. Just plows through it right away, throws it all away, and is down and out again.
Okay, we have a clip.
How does it feel to win such a life-changing sum of money?
Oh, well, I feel a hell of a lot better than yesterday.
What do you plan to do with 190,000 smackaroos?
I don't know. Maybe buy a house? Buy something nice for my boy, you know, just have a better life.
Okay, that's Andrea Riseborough there. As you say, she's British, so
Yeah.
Clearly acting. okay, let's move on to best song category. We have Rihanna's Lift Me Up. That gets a nomination from the film Black Panther, Wakanda Forever. There's Lady Gaga for the song Hold My Hand from Top Gun Maverick. Any other notables?
Yeah, the interesting thing here is that Diane Warren got nominated, her 14th nomination for Best Song. She's never won, but she was just given an honorary Oscar in November at the Governor's Awards for her total career. Yet here she is nominated again for a movie that basically no one's ever heard of this movie either, but it shows the power of her and the way her colleagues in the music branch think of her. The movie was a documentary called Tell It Like a Woman, and I've never even seen it, but the song Applause made the list here over Taylor Swift, who didn't get in for her song from When the Crawdads Sing. Many people thought she would. And the song that got in has been winning a few awards, Natu Natu, won the Golden Globe and the Critics' Choice Award, is from an Indian movie called RRR. And it's just a wild dance number. It's going to look so much fun on the Oscar show. Mm. First song ever from India, from an Indian movie to make it in here.
Also, David Byrne is nominated, right? From Everything, Everywhere, All at Once.
Again, that's the power of that movie, Everything, Everywhere, All at Once. 11 nominations, both for its music score and this song. So that just shows they were paying close attention to that movie for sure.
Yeah. And along with Mitski. All right. Since we're talking about snubs with a Taylor Swift snub, let's talk about The Woman King.
Yeah.
Snubbed. Big snub. Till.
When you asked me about surprises, I have to say that really surprised me. I've done a few Q&As with them. They've been out there. Gina Prince Bythewood, the director, Viola. So this was not an invisible campaign. This was very, very visible. And I was really shocked that it didn't get a single nomination. That was a shame, I think. And Viola Davis missing out in lead actress. Also, I have to say, Danielle Deadwyler in Till was expected too. And those are two Black actresses that could have gotten in easily and didn't make it this year. And I think that's a shame. Yes.
No women directors nominated this year.
No, there were a lot of really good movies directed by women this year. Woman King being one. Women Talking, which did earn a writing nomination and a Best Picture nomination for Sarah Pauley. There could have been any number. For the last 2 years in a row, a woman has won the Best Director Oscar. So we thought we were on an upward trajectory in terms of that. But this year proves the exception again.
Back to normal. All right. Looking at the documentary category, talk about the nominees there and who's favored to win.
This is a fairly predictable list of nominees for documentary feature. All That Breathes, which is an interesting movie about birds and helping them out from HBO Max. All the Beauty and the Bloodshed is Laura Poitras, who's a past Oscar winner. Fire of Love, which is great, from Nat Geo, is a great movie about two volcano experts, volcanists or whatever.
Volcanologists.
Volcanologists, which go out and follow volcanoes all over the place.
That is a beautiful movie.
It's a beautiful movie. A House Made of Splinters was a surprise to me because I've basically never heard of that. I'm sorry, I don't even know what it's about. And Navalny, which is, of course, about the imprisoned Russian protest leader who's in prison there now. This is his story as well.
Okay. Best animated feature film, Marcel, The Shell with Shoes On, which went from a homemade YouTube video to an Oscar nomination. Does it stand a chance against Pinocchio?
I really think that the front runner here, in my opinion, as well it should be, is Guillermo del Toro's gorgeous Pinocchio. I don't see it losing, but, you know, Marcel the Shell is a charming kind of movie and a sweet movie there. They're also Turning Red, a movie called The Sea Beast, which is also from Netflix, just like Pinocchio. I thought was excellent, too. That was a bit of a surprise. Puss in Boots sequel there made the list, too. But I do think it's Pinocchio's to lose.
Okay. So overall, you've got some big blockbusters nominated like Top Gun and Avatar. And do you think that this is the way a way for the Academy to try to lure in more viewers? Because viewership is really has really gone down in recent years. It was what, like 40 million a decade ago and down to 15 million now?
Yes. And, you know, it's climbing back from the pandemic, from a year when it was even less than 15 million. You know, that really took a chunk out. But it has been going down because they haven't been nominating these movies that people see out there. This year, they actually are probably dancing in the aisles over there at the Academy to get Top Gun Maverick, which was the year's number one movie for most of the year until Avatar, The Way of Water came out. Both of them got into the Best Picture race, and Elvis, which was a very large hit as well. And even Everything Everywhere All at Once, which was a very big movie, made over 100 million domestically for an indie movie. These are movies that have been seen. That's what I think drives ratings. The years that Titanic won, or Lord of the Rings, The Return of the King, the years that those kind of movies, big blockbuster movies, win, they do get better ratings.
The Oscar ceremony airs March 12th on ABC. Pete Hammond is Deadline's awards columnist and chief film critic. Pete, thank you.
Absolutely.
Lift me up. Keep me close, safe and sound.
Coming up, how the super rich employ complicated tax laws to shield their wealth. Often you never know how they do it. Well, now a wealth manager for three Getty sisters is revealing her secrets.
The old saying in the industry is, the whale that remains submerged does not get harpooned. This legal case sort of brought a whale to the surface of the water in quite a dramatic way.
That story is next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. The Getty family, one of the richest in the world, is an institution here in California. The Getty Museum, high up on a hill in Brentwood, is arguably the richest museum in the world. There's also the Getty Villa, that ocean-facing fake villa, housing priceless antiquities. The Gettys are also close to powerful politicians. Governor Gavin Newsom's father managed the family's trust for many years. Nancy Pelosi officiated the wedding of one of the Getty heirs recently. Now, a lawsuit involving the family and one of their former wealth managers has exposed how the Gettys have managed to avoid paying hundreds of millions of dollars in California taxes. The story reveals the financial tactics the ultra-wealthy use that end up widening the wealth gap here in America. Evan Osnos is a staff writer for The New Yorker, where he recently wrote about this, the Getty family. Welcome back to Press Play.
Thanks, Madeline. Glad to join you.
Well, overall, how much money does this family have? And remind us where it came from.
Well, the Getty family's fortune originated about a century ago when the great-grandparents of the generation that is written about in this piece first struck oil in Oklahoma, and then their son, J. Paul Getty, became one of the most famous people really in the world. He was at one point the richest man in America in 1957, probably the richest person in the world at the time. And his fortune grew over the years and then eventually was broken up into pieces to various branches of the family, each of which became very wealthy. And today, one branch belongs to the offspring of Gordon Getty, who is well-known philanthropist and composer in San Francisco. And he was last estimated to have about $2.1 billion. And it's not really known exactly how much the rest of the family has, but it's understood to be one of the great American fortunes.
Absolutely. So Gordon Getty is this big San Francisco society figure. He's a well-regarded composer married to Ann Getty. And secretly, he has been having an affair with another woman and has three daughters with this woman. So this is the branch that you're focused on. Tell us about these three daughters.
Yeah, they were raised, in fact, in L.A. They were part of what had been a not a publicly known affair until 1999, when their mother filed to get them established as legal descendants. And Gordon Getty acknowledged them, said he loved them very much, and then created a trust that would, in effect, cut them in on the family fortune. And the trust, according to the former wealth manager who filed suit against them and who has also been sued by them, she says that the trust is worth about $1 billion, and it belongs to three of these daughters. And that's become really the center of this quite contentious case.
So these three are, what, in their 30s, these three daughters?
Yeah, that's right. They're three young women who weren't heirs until they were in their teens. I mean, it was an unusual situation. They sort of discovered, after they'd already been around for a few years, that they were in fact descendants of this enormous wealth.
Okay, and they hired this woman named Marlena Sahn. Tell us about her and why the sisters chose to work with her.
Marlena Sahn is a wealth manager in New York who specialized in what she called progressive, ultra high net worth individuals. So it was kind of an interesting niche. It was people who wanted to figure out a way to take large sums of money and try to direct them towards liberal or progressive causes. So in some cases, they would try to get themselves out of investments that they regarded as problematic, things like fossil fuels, or try to get them in, or private prisons, and try to get them into more socially beneficial investments. And she was hired by two of the sisters, Kendall Getty and Sarah Getty, because they wanted to figure out a way to do this. And so they brought her on first to manage their individual assets, and then ultimately to help them basically running this giant trust fund worth, she says, about $1 billion.
And to make it ethical, because originally this money comes from oil, as you mentioned, and they don't like that.
Yeah, I mean, as she put it to me, Marlena Sahn said, "I try to figure out ways to help my clients get simpatico with their consciences." That was her way of describing it. And this, in the Getty's case, it was quite pronounced, because, you know, both of them described themselves as Bernie Sanders supporters. So they were trying to figure out a way how to live their values when it came to their finances.
So was she able to do that? Was she able to satisfy them, at least on that score?
Up to a point. It was going for a while. They were beginning to do that. They were beginning to move their investments around, getting out of things that they that she described as offender industries, getting them into more socially responsible investments. But then the relationship fell apart quite dramatically, actually. And what she says is that it fell apart in part because she objected to what she described as a dubious tax scheme. This is a something that the family denies. And she says that they were seeking to avoid hundreds of millions of dollars of taxes in ways that she didn't think was appropriate, didn't actually match up with the values that they professed. What they say is that everything they did was legal, according to the law.
Well, backtrack for a little bit. Explain, if you would, exactly what they're doing, because this is a California family, as we've established. They live in California, and yet they're holding their trust fund in Nevada. This is a way to avoid paying California taxes?
Under the law, if you can show that you did not do, quote unquote, a major portion of the work of the trust inside California, well, that's one of the ways that you can avoid having to pay California income taxes. Another thing you have to do is be out of the state at the time that you open the trust. And so one of the things that, according to family emails, that they discussed was the possibility of maybe leaving the state, as one of member of the family put it, for 1 to 2 years around the time of opening the trust. And that may well, in fact, be perfectly legal. That's not necessarily a thing that is against the law. In fact, if you have the lawyers and the accountants and the advisors who will help you do this, you can more or less decide at will what you're going to pay. And I think the reason why this, in the end, became what Marlene Son described as a dubious proposition was because she felt like it was not actually in the spirit of the law. And it was the kind of thing that lawyers will hash out. And she felt as if this was not something that was consistent with what they'd said they wanted to do. I should add, of course, they say that she was trying to get a bonus worth millions of dollars that they didn't think was justified, and that's the nature of their disagreement. Both sides, of course, deny the allegations.
Okay, let's get into that part in a little bit, but I just want to ask this question. Had they not professed to hold these Bernie Sanders values of the rich paying their fair share and of divesting from dirty industries like oil and being pro-environment, et cetera, had they just been regular run-of-the-mill, very rich people, would Marlene Son have had a problem with them trying to avoid paying taxes in California as much as she did? Was it the moral hypocrisy that bothered her?
I can't say for sure. It's hard to get in another person's head. What I can say is that she had been hired with them knowing quite clearly that this was her brand. This was her stated proposition. And for a time, she was actually one of the people who, by her own description, was maintaining the appearance that they were not living in California in order to minimize their exposure to state income tax. But at a certain point, she says, it became untenable. She says they were there so much, it just became, and they were doing work within the state that was beyond what is the threshold that you can, according to her, that she said, I can't be a part of this anymore. And she says that she went public for that reason. I think what's interesting, Madeline, is it's so rare that a wealth manager decides to break with a client and speak publicly about their client's financial arrangements, that it's one of the reasons why this is remarkable, because it gives you a window into these kinds of mechanics, these sort of the interior conversations inside a wealthy family that are generally not known to the outside.
Right. And then when you see in California how it plays out, because our finances here are really reliant on the super rich and just the regular rich, much of our state budget comes from capital gains taxes. So this kind of money is something that California really needs. And now we have a projected $22 billion deficit. So I guess the question is, I guess California is aware of these various tax avoidance schemes that families like the Gettys employ. Should they be cracking down on them? And is there a problem in California, particularly with the Gettys, because they are such a well-known, well-connected politically and frankly, personally, family with people in power like the Newsoms and the Pelosis?
I think one thing that becomes clear when you study a case like this in detail is that the kinds of things that most Americans think about when it comes to paying their taxes, you know, where do I live? How much did I earn in income this year? And how do I make sure I get this number correct when I send it in? Is really not the kind of thing that you have to think about when you get to the high end of the income ladder. That in fact, people can more or less define how much they want to pay by deciding where they're going to spend their time, 183 days in one state or stay out of the state and make sure that your real estate is arranged in such a way that you don't actually have to be subject to it. And I think that there's something there that when we talk about things like state deficits and budgets and how it is that we pay for the services that we need, oftentimes we overlook the fact that there is this underlying gymnastics, a kind of financial contortion that's going on constantly that allows some people to more or less decide what they want to pay. And that's not really how most Americans imagine the system was designed to work, I think.
Yeah. And nobody wants to pay a lot in taxes. Everyone's trying to figure out a way to cut their taxes. But you talk about something called MIGOS, which is an acronym from the late Senator Carl Levin, which stands for My Eyes Glaze Over, when it comes to all of these tax laws that have become increasingly complicated to the point of basically obfuscating how they really work to regular people. And so is that part of the, I guess, unstated plan on the part of the wealthy is to enact a lot of these pieces of legislation to make it so confusing that people don't even want to pay attention to it and let it keep going?
Well, it is a world in which it's full of these kind of arcane acronyms. So you might have a GRAT or a CRUT or a SLAT, and each one of these can be worth millions of dollars. For most Americans, these things are expensive. They're hard to understand, hard to gain access to. And so it creates this kind of two-tiered system where if you're fortunate enough to have the kind of advisors who both speak this language and also you're able to sort of spend money to save money, then you're able to just define your tax experience in a completely different way. And I think that's something that exists. Everybody knows on some level. You look at survey data, and we all know that there is this somewhat kind of two-tiered system. But it's the kind of thing that they're so far apart, they're so non-overlapping, that we don't often actually understand the details until mm-hmm. they're laid out, as they were in this case, in a court of law, in a legal complaint. And that's what brings it to public attention.
Yeah, well, let's talk about the legal complaint, because the Getty sisters end up firing Marlena's son. Then Kendall Getty files a lawsuit against her. What was that about?
Kendall and her advisors accused Marlena's son of pressuring her to give a bonus worth millions of dollars. They say she was violated her fiduciary duty in doing so. She says that's not true, that she deserved the bonus, it was warranted. And she filed suit afterwards in which she accused them of retaliating against her for objecting to what she called this, in her words, dubious tax scheme. And, you know, one of the reasons why it's so unusual is that typically in the wealth management world, the last thing you do, the last thing you want to do is burst into public view. You try to keep your clients out of it. You know, as one wealth manager said, the old saying in the industry is the whale that remains submerged does not get harpooned. This legal case sort of brought a whale to the surface of the water in quite a dramatic way. And that's why it became a matter of public interest.
Well, there is so much more in the article. I urge you to go read it in the current issue of The New Yorker. The story is called Trust Issues by my guest, Evan Osnos. Evan, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thanks, Madeline.
Up, what is old is new again. The appetite for TV reboots, but do we really want to see that 70s show again, even if it's the 90s? That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. It's Tuesday, so that means it's time, of course, for TV on the radio.
It was you who shot J.R.
Can I do my...
You're trying to get an idea for a show about nothing.
Exactly.
Are you in the mafia?
It's a stereotype, and it's
offensive.
Welcome to
the OC...
Old shows, they are back in again, a lot of them. Last week, NBC and Peacock debuted Night Court, that stars the original cast member John LaRoquette. And Netflix released That 90s Show, a reboot of That 70s Show, which much of the original cast making appearances. Over on CBS, their reboots are doing well of SWAT, The Equalizer, and CSI Vegas. Also in the making, a reboot of Ally McBeal and the sleeper comedy Party Down. Joining us to talk about TV's obsession with the reboot is Joelle Monique, freelance critic and executive producer at iHeartRadio. Welcome back.
Hi, Madam. Thanks for having me back. This is one of my favorite subjects, so I'm so excited to talk about reboots today.
Oh, my gosh. Okay. Well, what is a good reboot? Is there an art to it? Because I can imagine that a lot of the hardcore fans are like, don't mess with my memories.
So reboots are really tricky because fandom is very fickle and it's definitely angled and geared toward like specific shows. Fans are wanting very specific things in a world that is doing a lot of fan service, you know, between our Marvel movies, any kind of like Disney animated revisit. They've had a lot of those as well. I think giving fans what they want is definitely a no-no. You want to be surprised when you go see something. Be like, oh, I didn't see it coming and it was amazing. So it's hard to strike that balance of here's a little bit of what you wanted. Here's something unique and different you weren't expecting. Here's us playing homage to this original thing you loved, but also making it new and inviting new people in to watch. So it's a really difficult balance to strike.
You were talking about the art of a good reboot, and that made me think of Roseanne and what happened when they tried to bring that back. And then Roseanne got into trouble and she had to be taken off her show.
Yeah.
Her namesake. So I guess that was a reboot fail.
I think so. Roseanne is one of a very hard reboot to do. We have so many family-based TV shows in America. I mean, and across like animation and live action, comedy and drama, we have many, many period piece family sitcoms. We are, I think, over inundated with them. And so if you're not going to have that feel good, blue collar, middle of the road thing that I don't know necessarily exists anymore. I think we've become a much more divided country since Roseanne originally aired. I think it's hard to recapture that specific magic.
Mm-hmm. And yet the Conners is still on, right?
It's still on. People are still watching it. I guess what constitutes a fail? Like if the show is still running and people are still watching it, maybe fail is a very difficult, you know, it's not the right word, but I do think that then it becomes something different because you have to sort of address, hey, Roseanne, the entity that launched all of this, the thing that originally people were coming to check out. And then, you know, then you had John Goodman, who was obviously wonderful and a joy to watch. And then you kind of become attached to the kids. I guess with the reboot, you can go into a different character's storyline and really investigate. But to me, it just feels different. It feels like a different show. And I think I would have been fine if they had just started it as something different.
All right, let's talk about that 90s show on Netflix, a reboot of Fox's That 70s Show with a lot of the original cast, Mila Kunis, Ashton Kutcher, they're married now, Topher Grace, and et cetera, with the notable exception of Danny Masterson, who's facing a second rape trial. Mm-hmm. This first one ended in mistrial. So does the show deal with that at all? Or is he just doesn't exist? He just doesn't exist.
I have only seen the pilot, and so far it seems like he's just not going to be brought up, which is okay with me. fine with that.
Moving on. But what does it say about how reboots, again, dealing with the Roseanne situation, have to deal with events that happened to the stars since the originals aired?
I think oftentimes with a reboot, you're getting a line. Like if an actor either cannot come back because of decisions they've made, or if they just choose not to come back, there's always a space to sort of reference them, be like, oh, that was so funny when so-and-so was here. With that 90s show, there are so many characters that do return. Like, why dwell on the one guy who isn't here?
Okay, so let's talk about some upcoming reboots you are excited about. One of them is more like a revival for a show called Party Down. And the new trailer doesn't have any dialogue, so let's listen to the original trailer. It stars Jane Lynch, before her star turn on Glee, Adam Scott, pre-Parks and Rec, and Megan Mullally.
Everyone at Party Down is waiting for their big break.
Were you that guy?
Are we having fun yet? You're that guy.
More of a Colin Farrell. Dangerous, yet vulnerable.
You're an actress.
Wipe your mouth.
Party Down, I don't really remember this one. Should I?
It was a sleeper hit, right? So it's on Starz. It had a bunch of people before they really hit mainstream. This is Martin Starr before he's on Silicon Valley. Adam Scott, as you mentioned before he gets to Parks and Recs. And so for people who were in it, they're like, this is so biting. It's very acidic. It's very Hollywood too, which I think, you know, doesn't often play well outside of our little corner of the world, but it is so funny. Like the cast is great. I had a ton of really great guest appearances. You know, Jane Lynch is like an icon, and she's so like, just that her signature dry humor really adds to this series. And what makes me really excited to see it come back is failed actors, writers, Hollywood types, I think, is always fresh for examination. We've had such a drastic change since the show went off the air. I think like 13 years ago, we've really seen a boom in streaming. Everything is different about how the industry operates. And therefore, I think there's a lot of opportunities for these characters who were struggling in the late aughts. Like, how did they survive these big changes? And if they're all in exactly the same place, obviously they didn't quite reach the heights they did, or maybe they did reach a height and have now like come back to their starting point. I just think there's a lot in there, and for so much of the cast to return, I have really high hopes. We don't know yet what the story is going to be about. We do know it's going to pick up kind of where it left off, and it'll explore those 10 years. That's all we know, which I think is it's great. It gives you a chance to just be surprised.
So this is about a group of actors who are caterers to make money, right?
Yes.
That's the general premise. So 10 years later, maybe we're looking at some who made it and obviously some who didn't, and we're focusing on the ones who didn't.
Yes.
And Jane Lynch is in it. I'll watch anything she's in.
Me too. Lizzie Kaplan can't come back. She's the only one. There was just a scheduling conflict. I'm hoping if we get more than these 6 episodes, we'll get some more of her character because she's great. But we also know Jennifer Garner is going to make an appearance, Tyler Jackson Williamson, and Zoe Chow. So I'm really eager to see how they handle a lot of characters who were purposefully problematic in their time, you know, and how are they going to sort of address those issues and update them for a modern audience. I think it's going to be fabulous.
So it's kind of meta too, because we now know these stars as stars, right? We're looking at Adam Scott differently now. We're looking at Jane Lynch differently now.
Definitely. I think it'll have, if people have seen Everywhere All at Once, there's a moment where Michelle Yeoh is thrust into the life of a movie star, and the whole scene plays super funny because obviously she is a world famous superstar, and
yeah,
but she's so uncomfortable in the role, and she really gets to ham that up there. I think we'll be seeing a lot of that here as well.
Okay, Party Down debuts February 24th on Starz. Next up, Ally McBeal, a Gen Xer favorite. What's happening with this reboot?
Okay, I'm very excited for Ally McBeal. I was a little tight when this was coming out, but I was very much driven to be like, I want to be a woman in industry in a mini skirt with a jacket going through it. I want the drama invited in. And I think Disney has done these women-led in professional spaces shows really, really well. You mentioned Night Court earlier. Of course, they have Grey's Anatomy as one of their flagships, still going strong to this day. And so they're going to make some adjustments and changes. So instead of picking up with Ally McBeal, they're going to put a Black woman in the lead, which I'm very excited about. David E. Kelley has graciously stepped away. He's like, I don't know how to tell that story, but I really want to support Karen Gist, who started her career on Girlfriends with Mara Brock-Akil. Her last success was Mike, the short series about Mike Tyson, the boxer, on Hulu. She also did Camp Rock for Disney fans who are into that genre. So she understands music, comedy, and drama, which I think really lends itself to the world of Ally McBeal, which is like women in professional spaces, you know, falling in love and out of love and trying to win cases and assert themselves in these spaces. So I'm really looking forward to, you know, what does this updated lawyer show look like? There are a ton of Black women lawyers in television history whom mm-hmm. we love. And so I'm excited to have a new one to the canon here.
There are quite a few reboots of shows that previously starred white actors, now with people of color in the lead. Mm-hmm. The Equalizer, Quantum Leap, The Wonder Years. Is it working?
Again, I think it's hit or miss. You know, I've heard people kind of like The Wonder Years. We know it got renewed for season 2. I don't know about season 3 yet. I think The Equalizer is going pretty well. Queen Latifah is killing that role.
Yeah.
I think you have to base it in something other than, oh my gosh, we just need a person of color. I think when you just jam a person of color in there and then don't look at the lives people of color lead or really try to construct a character that's different from the white person they're now filling in for, that's when you end up with a lot of struggle, because why would people connect to that? You know, it's artificial. But when it's done well and thoughtfully, I think we can have a lot of success.
Okay, moving on to a series that has 9 or more lives, a sitcom about football called The Game.
After a league-wide vote, the league is officially on strike.
Malik, how long can the players hold out?
Oh, as long as it takes. The players are united.
Let them play!
No justice, no peace!
This is important.
And so is this, Garrett.
Okay, that doesn't sound like a comedy. Was this show still a comedy, or what is it?
It's not as much of a sitcom, so it certainly made some adjustments from the original series. The original Game, as it premiered on CW, was very much about a girl who got a scholarship to a great college. She wants to become a doctor, but her boyfriend gets picked up for a football team. She's like, I'm going to go with him. So immediately, many ladies are like, oh, girl, what are you doing? Danger. And then it's cheating and baby mamas and very soap opera. And it was very entertaining. But then as it gets to BET, it becomes about women trying to lead in positions as coaches and heads of PR and managers and things like that. And so now it's got a different sort of dimension. It also picks up a lot more on what is it like to be Black and in the NFL and trying to spin off into coaching or ownership, which, you know, it's constantly in the headlines. If you add to that the real life drama of football, which is brain injuries and insurance for those who, you know, don't play more than 5 years is very low. There's a lot of good spaces to explore in both a dramatic and comedic way. So they've gotten rid of the laugh tracks. It's less silliness, but still really good. Tasha Mack, played by Wendy Robinson, is still my fave. I think this is such an interesting character. We don't have many women. I think maybe a Cookie. She's like a more toned down Cookie from Empire. And I love it. I really enjoyed season one. I'm hoping that we get more coming down the line.
All right. The game that can never die, streams Thursday nights on Paramount Plus. And then finally, there's a rumor that there might be a reboot of True Blood. You know, the vampire show from way back in the day.
So as of February 2022, so almost a year since I think we've had any proper updates, everyone was like, it's a little chaotic and we're not sure which direction we're going in, but we are still expecting it to happen. It wouldn't surprise me if we got a message tomorrow saying it's canceled. However, vampires are still doing strong game. I'm sure they were very inspired by Interview with the Vampire. They're like, look, we could do something like that. We could get more money. I hope it comes back just because I'm interested to see. I don't know if they have a good storyline idea. I don't know who's coming back, but I really enjoyed watching True Blood. It was appointment television for me. So I hope they figure out a way to bring it back.
Well, vampires always come back. What are you talking about? You can't kill a vampire.
Exactly. Exactly.
Joelle Monique, freelance critic and executive producer at iHeartRadio. Thank you.
Thank you for having me. This was lovely.
And that'll do it for us today on Press Play. Don't forget, you can download and subscribe to our podcast. It's at kcrw.com/pressplay or wherever else you get your podcasts. I'm Madeline Brand. I will see you tomorrow.